Hey, welcome to episode number 12 of the First Responder Wellness Podcast, the show where we talk about wellness, mental health, leadership, and what it takes to have a wellness culture within your organization. My name is Conrad Weaver. I'm a filmmaker, podcast host, and the director of the award-winning film PTSD 911. For the past 4 years, I've been working with first responders from all across the country to bring wellness to the forefront of our conversation. And today, I'm talking with Keith Hanks. Keith is a former firefighter and EMT who retired after 21 years of service. He has been an advocate for PTSD and mental illness awareness, suicide prevention, and breaking the stigma since 2015. Keith is currently working on his first book about his own life and experience with PTSD. He has been a national speaker and podcast guest on a subject of PTSD, mental illness, and substance abuse, as well as suicide awareness. And he has participated in a number of documentaries and training videos related to the subject. And he currently lives in New Hampshire with his wife and is a father to three amazing children. Stay tuned for my conversation with Keith Hanks. Hey, I really appreciate you listening to the podcast. And if you think others would too, I ask you to subscribe and to share. That helps us get the word out to others. I also want you to know that you can now access these interviews on our YouTube channel for free. Visit youtube.com and search PTSD 911 movie. And we are looking for sponsors for this program. If you are interested in supporting what we do here at the First Responder Wellness Podcast, I'd love to talk with you. Shoot me an email and we can get the conversation going to see how this show can be a fit for you and your organization. I really appreciate it. Thanks again for listening. And now here's my interview with Keith Hanks. Well, Keith, welcome to the First Responder Wellness Podcast. Thanks so much for joining me today. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, Conrad. Thanks for having me again.
So what has been happening up in your neck of the woods? You're up in New England, right?
I am in southern New Hampshire. I am actually, as the crow flies, I'm 2.5 miles south of the second most hiked mountain in the world. Ironic. Mount Monadnock. So
I have not heard of that. I've heard of like Mount Washington or something. Yeah. Is that in Maine?
No, that's New Hampshire too. That's
New Hampshire.
Yeah, 2 hours from me. But it's cold. It was 25 degrees this morning, and we had snow squalls all last night.
Wow.
So
We had here in Maryland, we had 30 degrees. Actually, it was 28 this morning. So wow, that's
cold.
That pretty unusual for November 2nd. So, but that's not. You guys are used to all this cold weather, right?
Yeah. See, that's the funny thing about New England. We like to call it our bipolar weather because we've had feet of snow on Halloween, we've had, you know, as much as like six or 8 inches on the second week of May, and then we'll have 55, 60 degree days at Christmas. And they have a saying in New England, if you don't like the weather, give it 10 minutes. And it literally is quite that simple.
So let me ask you that, as a first responder, you know, how did the weather impact what you guys did?
Everything. And honestly, winters were probably easier to deal with than some of the other weather systems just because.
Really?
Because we know in winter that it was just going to be cold. Right. And, there's going to be ice if anything's wet. But like the weather, especially in the spring and the summer up here, is very unpredictable. And it made, more specifically, not so much on the firefighting end of things, but on like EMS, like working with on the ambulance or something, trying to get patients to and from, you know, either the house to the ambulance or the ambulance to an emergency room. You would have to, you know, deal with, you know, hurricane force winds or rain. And these things just pop up randomly up here. It's like a magician's hat, you know, just randomly, you know, shit'll just come up and happen in the middle of being a sunny day. You know, next thing you know, it's 40 and the wind's blowing and it's raining. So it's it hampered a lot of things, and you had to be ready for just about anything. And I think that's what makes first responder work in the Northeast kind of unique.
You know, that's something that I need to find some other people as well to talk, you know, different parts of the country and how weather impacts, you know, what you guys do. Because I know, you know, down in the South where they have hurricanes and stuff, of course, you guys have hurricanes up north.
Sometimes.
At least on the coast there. But how does that, you know, that those are huge events, right? for these agencies.
Yeah, especially like when you go out, you know, southwest, like, you know, Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and you have the extreme heats. Yeah. That takes a toll on you when you're in, especially like firefighters, when you're wearing all the turnout gear all the time.
Sure.
It takes a toll on you.
Yeah. And I remember seeing, I forget where it was. I think it was here locally. It was in the heat of the summer. There was a big fire. You know, these guys are all wearing their turnout gear. And it's like, how are they managing that? Right. You know, and even when I was filming with Maddie out in California, the one day that I was on a ride along with him, you know, it was pretty warm day. And, you know, they're out there on the scene of an accident wearing all the bunker all gear, the you know, and yeah, all the stuff. And we hopped on the back of the ambulance and got to the hospital. And after they dropped the patient off, you know, Maddie came out with a couple bottles of Gatorade for me and for the other guys that are on the scene. You know, it's like, here, drink this because you're going
to
need it.
And you have to stay hydrated.
So give us a little bit of your backstory, kind of the cliff notes of your backstory for our viewers, our listeners.
Sure. So I was a firefighter and EMT out here in Massachusetts for 21 years. I worked from 1996 to 2017. I worked for mainly municipal fire departments, you know, fire and EMS, and then I worked for several privatized EMS agencies in bigger cities that are out here. And I worked primarily as pretty much right away as a training officer and field training officer. Really enjoyed working with the new folks as they came in and trying to mold the young minds, if you will. As time went on, a lot of the symptoms and stuff that I was already having because of different traumas in my life sort of just got to be too much, and that combined with the job and what the job had done ended up spelling disaster for my career. And I ended up going out on disability in 2017. And, I have become an advocate and done a lot of different parts of that to try to make it so other people don't hopefully go down the same path, or at least not for as long as I and, several other advocates have. Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's common for first responders who, you know, jump into this business, so to speak, that so many kind of bring along with them traumas and stuff from the past? And maybe that even kind of speaks to why they become first responders.
I do. And, you know, over the years, I've been, honored to be part of, you know, a lot of research that's been done. Some as simple as like, you know, questionnaires, and some as like, you know, actual research projects. And one of the biggest things they find with a lot of first responders that are asked this question is, most of us have childhood trauma. And it's like a big percentage from the studies I've been part of. It's like 70-75% of at least male first responders come with childhood trauma. And I think, and I can only speak for, you know, for me, but I know a lot of other men who say this. A lot of the reason why I did the job is I wanted to be there for people because no one was there for me. And it goes beyond just helping someone. There's a lot of ways you can help people, but as a first responder, I think we're drawn to it. A lot of us are drawn to it because we want to be there on someone's worst day because someone wasn't there for us on ours.
And so when you carry all that trauma into the job and you haven't dealt with it, then it's going to rear its ugly head at some point, right?
It's bound to happen. And I think we always are showing, you know, some of the signs. I think most of us carry some form of it somehow. And I think because of what the job is and in certain parts of it, how the danger aspect, I think, is what sort of gets a lot of us to continue to do it, because it's almost like a relief. You know, when you're doing the job and there's a lot of stress, it sort of distracts from some of the other, traumas that may be there from your past.
So it makes you not think about that and have to deal with it, because you're dealing with what's in the moment right in front of you, right?
Right. Until everything's in your face and you have no choice but to deal with it, right?
Yeah. And you're not sleeping at night, and you're find yourself at the wrong end of a bottle and all that stuff, right?
All the bad coping skills and all the things that, I mean, they're talked about more now, but all the things that for, you know, generations and decades weren't talked about.
Mm-hmm. You know? What, in your experience, what happened, you know, early on when you're going through training, when you're in the academy, what did they talk about? Did they talk about mental health? Did they talk about any of these things?
Not in the mid 90s. They really didn't. And, you know, there was the, you know, psychological end of like the medical side, maybe a little bit back then, but even that wasn't as touched upon as it is obviously now. But for me, one of the biggest like pivotal moments was one of the first, you know, critical incident stress meetings I went to within the first 4 months of being on the job. And it was handled so poorly. And, you know, it was involving a fatal fire where someone died. It was a murder suicide. And we almost lost our fire chief. And it was, you know, it was a big deal. Right. And I was very young. There was three other members that were very young, and it was sort of the person running it asked the question if anyone wanted to talk, as if we were bothering them if we did, you know. And when you're 18 or even just being on the job period and no one speaks and it's made that speaking's an inconvenience, that carries for a long time. And for a very long time, a lot of these schisms were handled like that. And a lot of that sort of built up that wall with the stigma where we weren't talking about it to begin with. And we were actually going backwards when it came to, hey, we do a stressful job, but we're not going to talk about it. Suck it up.
Mm-hmm. Well, at what point did you begin talking about it? Or what point did you begin to realize, looking at yourself, that, hey, I'm kind of screwed up?
It was a ways in. I had lost my first wife in a car accident in 2003. And so I had about 7 years on the job at that point, and I was doing both jobs. I was working, you know, private EMS and my fire job. And I spiraled shortly after that for obvious reasons. And within a couple of years of that happened, I realized there was more up there that was bothering me than just the death of my wife, than just the job. And there was things that I've been burying, and I knew I was acting in ways that were not conducive with a healthy lifestyle. And so probably I would say, you know, probably about 10 years into the job, I really started to do some self-reflection that something isn't right.
Mm-hmm. And so do you think that that's kind of a normal thing, that people in the fire service in general aren't really that self-aware as far as how these things are affecting them? Or maybe they're not willing to admit it?
I think it's a little bit of not willing to admit it because it's vulnerability. Mm-hmm. I know vulnerability for me was very scary. You know, I embrace it now. But, you know, as a male in his 20s and, you know, 30s, it was we rely on our ego. And vulnerability would take away from that. And I think to allow yourself to be like, these things have bothered me, whether you have, you know, past trauma or not, the job bothering me makes me weak, because that mentality has been sort of pushed, because, you know, in the military and first responder world, you have to be tough. You have to be, you know, the tough guy or girl all the time. And that's fine when you're on, but I think we've always made it so we don't allow ourselves to feel the magnitude of what this job really entails, you know, all the pillars of the first responder world, what it entails. And that takes vulnerability, and vulnerability is scary to someone who hasn't been encouraged to embrace it.
Mm-hmm. You know, at some point it's part of the job of having to set aside your feelings and emotions to do the job. Mm-hmm. You know, you're trained to respond and you're trained to do this thing and to take care of the business in front of you. So at some point, you know, there has to be some kind of a disconnect so that you can accomplish. Because if you're coming onto a scene and it's a horrific scene and you're falling apart yourself, you can't help the other people, right?
Exactly.
So where's that balance?
And that's the thing, right? And they train you from the get-go, no matter how you get into the field from day one, they train you how to turn everything off and deal with other people's emergencies. And that was always what was said to me. This is someone else's emergency, not yours. And it's true. Mm-hmm. And so they teach you to turn the dials down very well. Military, they do it even better. And that's fine. What they don't teach you what to do is when you're not in utter chaos and you're not dealing with emergencies and you're, you know, off shift or you're back at the station, the kitchen table, whatever it is, they don't teach you how to kind of bring those up to even like maybe like a 6 or a 7 instead of a 10 to be able to appreciate that the chaos and the stress isn't happening. And hey, that situation was really awful. And, you know, it does, I do feel it. They don't teach you that. And I think that's part of what I think a lot of us out there that are talking about it now, it goes beyond just telling war stories. It goes like, hey, this is how you don't need to be 40 years old and having a full realization of all the shit you've been through. It's, you can live the life of being a very good first responder, a good provider, and also being mentally healthy by being allowing yourself to turn those dials back down to the normal operating limits instead of being at a 10 all the time.
Mm-hmm. You know, as a storyteller myself, I think stories are hugely important to any subject, and especially to this. Do you think there comes a time when it's enough of the stories and more of the, okay, how do we move forward? How do we move past that?
Yeah, I think, and it's a balancing act, honestly. And I've learned that in the last, well, I've been telling my parts of my story for a while, but like public speaking wise, standing in front of people, it's been like 3 years. And you realize very quickly that people can appreciate and it gives you credibility to give stories on what you've done. You know, sure. I've been in some really awful situations, blah, 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 blah. That's fine. But to balance the credibility and getting a, you know, a relationship with folks because of what you've been through and being like, this is how we get through it and this is how you survive in the moment is a real balancing act. And I think it's more important for people to know the how than to hear necessarily the why. We all know why. Mm-hmm. We all know why we end up drinking and why we end up drugging and why we end up having nightmares and why we overwork. We know why. How do we get through it? And I think that's a balancing act when you take on the role of, you know, either teaching this or speaking to people or bringing awareness to this. It's not just, you know, war stories 24/7. You know, that's what the kitchen table's for.
Mm. Yeah. So what was your how? How did you get past that? How did you get to the point where you're in a healthier spot? What was that journey like?
Honestly, I had to hit my breaking point, and that is not, that is not how we do it. We don't need to hit our breaking point. And that's one of the things I always tell people. And so for me, it was, you know, hitting that breaking point and then, finding what works and realizing what I need to do that I could have done before, which I can't go back and do, obviously. And so the biggest thing is, you know, utilizing, you know, resources. And people often are like, okay, mental health, we got therapy and we got meds. And, you know, that's all we got. And that couldn't be further from the truth. There's a lot, there's so much that people, especially first responders, can do themselves. And, you know, Vance is one of those guys. He's in the yoga. And, you know, you ask any guy who's been a first responder for more than 5 minutes. And for the most part, yoga, you know, Reiki and all these other things, these holistic modalities have always been kind of frowned upon. And most of them do more for you than a pharmaceutical will. And I've realized that in order for me, and if I could have done this while on the job, it would have been super beneficial, which is what I tell people. I feel things now, and that sounds weird. And a lot of people who have lived their life being able to feel things kind of like, well, yeah, of course. But men specifically, but anyone who goes through a lot of trauma and first responders fall into this category, we stop feeling. And we do it in a protection sort of way for ourselves where, well, that's too much. And when it's too much, I get angry. I don't want to be angry. So I just don't feel it. And then we stop feeling everything. And that's not how you heal. What I have found with my healing, the biggest healing for me has been embracing what is happening and beyond talk therapy, experiencing the feelings associated with these events, be it on the job, personal, childhood, whatever it is, embracing those feelings and being able to figure out where they came from and why they're happening so I can somewhat control them, more so control my reactions when they come up. Mm-hmm. And that's really where the how is mm-hmm. we have to feel to heal.
Mm-hmm. You know, something that there's a point in my film where Nicole, the dispatcher, is talking about a critical instance she goes through and she says, everyone was feeling, but I'm not. Mm-hmm. I wasn't feeling. And then she ended up, you know, kind of cutting herself with a knife just to make sure she can feel.
Yep.
And so that's that can bring you to a place where, to a dangerous place in your life. If you know, you continue to not feel, especially if you start realizing that can be in a dark place.
And you hear it all the time. You hear, it's usually the wives, but you hear spouses all the time say about the first responder, I just wish he'd feel something. It's like he doesn't have an emotional spectrum whatsoever. And I've been told that numerous times until, you know, obviously recently. But it's because we shut everything off because we think that's the answer. And it actually isn't, you know?
And so what is the answer?
The answer is we have to feel these things. You know, the answer is instead of, you know, I think as a whole, we've done a lot of work in the first responder world when it comes to bringing awareness to trauma and, you know, what we were doing wrong in the past. But we're still being very reactive, which is what we do in our job. We wait till something happens and we go and fix it. Mm-hmm. And we're doing that right now with mental health. And most of the things that we're trying to accomplish are being very reactive. Okay, so here's a list of resources. Here's an 800 number. Here's some therapists. Even peer support in some regards are being used in a wait till something happens capacity. Mm-hmm. And more, we're starting to see the more proactive end of things. What can we be doing to prepare for when this affects us? And maybe making it so it doesn't have to affect us like it has people, you know, like me in the past. You know, what can we do to be better prepared to embrace what we do for work and really, when appropriate, feel the magnitude of what our work entails and the fact that we are literally called to have our best days, quote unquote, on someone else's worst day. And we really need to try to embrace that. And I think by denying that is what gets a lot of us, you know, at some point into hot water with whatever form of, you know, problems with mental health, whether drinking, drug and whatever it is, divorce, suicide. Mm-hmm.
You know, I was talking with someone recently and we were talking about this issue and I kind of compare it to an athletic team who they hire these guys, they recruit these top athletes, and then they invest everything into their health and wellness. And they that the best equipment, the best coaches, the best, you know, nutritionist, all the things so that this athlete can perform at his or her very best because they want to win.
Yep.
Right. So what are first responders doing to help their athletes win?
When it comes to the aspects of their job, they're doing a lot. I mean, you look at any sort of convention or conference, that's a general one. And there's 150 ways to drag a hose. There's, you know, 36 different ways to take down a perp. There's 76 different ways to answer a 911 call and, you know, talk someone through CPR, whatever it is. There's all that for on the job stuff, right? But mental health, there's just starting to be, in the last 5 years, there's just starting to be some conversations. And, you know, really it comes down to, you know, we really need to invest as much, if, you know, in some cases, if not more, time in, you know, training for mental health for us, not even like the psychological emergencies we deal with on the street, you know, mental wellness and health for us, needs to be from the academy and it needs to be throughout the career, because it's not just the job that gets affected. Our families get affected. We obviously get affected, but our families get affected. The public can be affected by this, and we see it all the time. You know, these are things that we need to be more proactive with, and we need to take a preemptive step with to better prepare not just the first responders that are on the street, but generations down the road to be able to handle, you know, not just the stuff they do on the job, but the stuff they're going to encounter in their personal life that they don't need to react to like they're on the job.
I mean, you talk about, you want people, and as a citizen, I want peak performance out of my first responders. You know, end of discussion. I want peak performance.
Yep.
I want the very best to come with their very best. And man, so many times that's not the case.
It's not. And there's a lot of really good first responders out there. You know, I've known a lot of great men and women who have done different parts of this job. And unfortunately, you know, a lot of them have had their careers cut short. And you can almost draw a lateral to it being mental health. And it doesn't need to be that way, because there are people, and you probably get this. There are people, I have friends who are like in the banking world, who are like, what do you mean you guys don't take like 5 minutes to try to collect yourself and deal with the stressors of your job and how awful this is? What do you mean it's frowned upon to take a day off or a shift off after you did like, you know, 5 dead babies in a shift? Or maybe like, you know, you got some personal stuff going on that's affecting your job. Why is that frowned upon? Like, there's people in the general population who hear stories of how we deal with, you know, our mental health days. And they're like, are you kidding me? And when you step back, which I've been able to do, when you step back and look at it, it's like, wow, this really is a shit show. This is pretty bad.
What would you do differently if you know what you know now? And you go back to the beginning of your career, what would you do differently?
Honestly, I would have started even before that. I would have started when I was in high school. But if I had to have waited till I got on the job, I would have immediately started, you know, talking about, you know, the stuff I had been through. I would have, because for years, you know, I denied that. And other men who have childhood trauma will often say this as well, first responder wise. At the end of the day, it was really the stuff from our childhood that's causing so much of a melee in our head. It really, when you start dealing with that, the bad calls sort of file themselves. At least that's been the case with me and several people I know. And honestly, I would have started facing, you know, that scared little boy that was always up there, that was up there until I was almost 40. And I would probably still be on the job. This would have been my 27th year. And if I had dealt with that stuff back in the beginning, or had the resources and the encouragement and support to do so, I could still be on the job. And that could probably be said for a lot of other men and women that cut their career short because it wasn't encouraged. And in some capacities, it still isn't encouraged. To show that vulnerability and that things have affected you.
I know as far as law enforcement, I believe there's a psychological test they have to take. Is there something like that in the fire service?
It depends on the department. Some larger departments do it. Typically, at least in Massachusetts, when you go through the Mass Civil Service, most of those departments will end up having you take some sort of psychological exam. But it's one of those things that ask you questions like, do you like to have sex with sheep? You know, it's not, and I'm serious. Like, I mean, some of these psychological exams are just there to make sure you're not batshit crazy.
Right.
And,
but you can still be screwed up in other ways, right?
You can lie on these things. I mean,
sure.
You know, as a halfway decent human being, how to answer certain questions. And specifically with trauma, specifically, even more specifically with people with childhood trauma, you learn how to cover it up very well. And, it's not so much a matter of just grilling people on whether they're sane or not. It's a matter of, you know, sort of creating a more supportive environment that allows people to, on their own, want to be vulnerable and want to share this to get better. Because no one wants to be sad. No one wants to be angry. No one wants to be traumatized by the things they go through. No one wants that. A healthy person doesn't want that. But because we have created such a culture in the first responder world and even society, but first responder world, that sort of has always frowned on mental health, it's more than just, hey, just reach out. You know, when you have a culture that frowns upon reaching out, no one's going to reach out. So we got to create that sort of, it's okay not to be okay. Just don't stay there sort of thing. You know what I mean?
These things take a long time to, you know, we've had a lot of experience and first responders, you know, like yourself had years of trauma that have built up. And so, and a culture that over the years has said, suck it up, buttercup, you know, here's a beer. How can you change that culture within an organization to get to a healthy place? It's going to take some time.
And that really is what it is. I mean, in the fire service, especially, we have the expression, depending on the amount of years, but, you know, 150 years of tradition unimpeded by progress. And it's very true. From the stuff on the job to, you know, mental health, it takes a long time. And every pillar of the first responder world is the same. It doesn't matter if you're a dispatcher, corrections officer, law enforcement, EMT, it doesn't matter. We're all very stubborn. And the good thing is that, you know, the conversations are being had. At 45 years old, and growing up around the fire service in the military world, I've never seen the culture where it is. I've never seen it where people are openly talking about it. And, you know, it's hard sometimes because the suicide rates are astronomical in the first responder world. Mm-hmm. I honestly think they're going to get worse before they get better. But at no other time that I've been alive have I seen grown men and women getting up and talking about this subject. And it is slowly, like, you know, a glacier on molasses, very slowly starting to change it. And you're seeing it. You're seeing more first responder retreats and treatment facilities, culturally competent therapists and providers. You're seeing first responder specific equine therapy, yoga, meditation. You're seeing more of this happen, which is all part of what needs to take place to create that culture where it is supported and understood and accepted that people have trauma, people bring trauma to the job, and the job traumatizes people. And that's all okay because it can all be dealt with. And I think we're slowly getting there. We're at least not going backwards now.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a difference? I don't know if you guys have a lot of volunteer organizations up in your area, but do you think that there's a difference between a fully staffed paid crew and or an all volunteer organization?
I think there's a difference in the way they are able to allocate resources. I think because a lot of it, as we all know, it all comes down to money. Mm-hmm. I think whether you're on the New York City Fire Department or you're on, you know, Joe Shit, the Ragman's volley squad in a town of 600 people, you're still going to be affected by trauma because the underlying common denominator is that you're a human being.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And I think the issue becomes access to either education, knowledge, training, or resources. And a lot of the volunteer departments don't get that as much as the more fully staffed ones that, you know, have a budget and, you know, especially ones that fall under like unions, because they tend to take care of them a little bit better. I think that's really the only difference. I don't think when it comes down to the demographic of the members, I think the drive to do the job is about the same. I think the capacity to be affected by trauma is exactly the same. I think it's just access, really.
Sure. I think too, just looking at, so here in Emmitsburg, you know, we have I think mostly volunteer fire company, at least on the fire side, there's paid people on the ambulance side. But I've even in hanging around them and talking, you know, about some of these things, I can kind of tell there's a little bit of a disconnect there compared to some of the fully staffed places that I've seen, you know, the paid people I've seen. And I think it might be that, you know, some of these people, you know, a lot of the people here, you know, come from rural communities, they're farmers, they're, you know, people that are in blue collar jobs, and mental health is probably not on the front of mind for these people.
It probably isn't.
There's no judgment. There's no judgment on them. It's just kind of the way it is.
It is that for sure. And I also think it's with a lot of like the on-call and volunteer aspects of, you know, fire and EMS. I think that for a lot of people, it's an immediate shut off because a lot of these people, you know, leave a job or leave their family, go to the station, do the call, and then have to immediately get back into that work or family dynamic. And I think, and I've done it. I mean, I did all aspects, you know, full-time, part-time, on-call. I know that you got to do a hard stop when you hop off that truck and you park that truck in the station and you go back to the birthday party you were just at, or you go back to the assembly line or whatever it is you're doing for work, you have to hard stop it and not deal with it. And so I think it's there. I think the mental health aspect is there. I think, but even more so on the volunteer level, I think they deny it even more because they're hopping off of their emergency vehicles and whatnot and getting away from the calls and having to stop it immediately to go back to whatever they were doing when those tones dropped.
And many times they don't have that, that dinner table conversation with the others that were on the call.
No, we used to call it tailboard therapy. You sit on the ramp in the back of the truck for a few minutes before you go back home, but you don't have those hours in between calls or those, whatever it is, at the kitchen table to diffuse some of this stuff. So at some, in some regards, yeah, the full timers are at a better advantage because at least they have their crew and their shift to, you know, navigate some of this.
It'd be interesting to get someone from the National Volunteer Fire Council to be on the program to talk about that. I'll have to reach out to them and see if we can have a conversation about that specifically for the volunteer organizations, because I think that's an important part of, you know, that there's many, I mean, I don't know how many thousands of volunteer stations there are across our country, but that's a big part, especially in the East here. It's a huge part of our communities.
It's big. And I know there's more non-full-time firefighters than there are full-time in this country. And now there's a shortage of both. But where I'm at in New Hampshire, we are almost all, if not exclusively on call and volunteer, their combination where they'll have a couple guys or a couple members on during the day, but it's almost exclusively run by volunteers. And every one of these stations have help wanted signs outside their doors. And I've never seen that. I've never seen, you know, such a deficit in staffing.
I'm, you know, here in Emmitsburg, I was permitted to get the IM responding app. And so I get all the calls and get the notifications for all that. And I mean, I have the emergency thing turned off, so it doesn't like wake me up in the middle of the night. But I get the text messages, but I see texts come through. Hey, if you're available, you know, on a first due or second due ambulance, please, you know, sign in. And it's like, because it's all volunteer, you know? And so that's a challenge. And as somebody in the community, I'm like, holy cow, are they not, if my house is on fire, are they going to show up? You
know? It's scary, right? And I don't think the public is aware of what's really happening. And I'm convinced that a lot of the staffing and retention problems we're having in the first responder world right now has almost, not entirely, but a large percentage to do with mental health and wellness and the fact that we're not taking care of ourselves. And I think word is out. I think, you know, a lot of folks, you know, my age and older are always like, oh, you know, millennials just don't want to do this job. And it's like, that may be a component, but word is out. We don't take care of ourselves. Why is someone going to come run into a burning building when they can go down the road and flip burgers for $2 less an hour? I mean, these days, I mean, that's a big thing. And, you know, I think, honestly, we owe it to ourselves, the public, the next generation of first responders to, you know, make this a job people want to do, whether it's full-time, volunteer, or whatever. I think we need to get back to taking care of ourselves and make this a job that people want to come to, because we are taking care of ourselves. And I think that we just don't, we're not doing a good enough job. And I think word's gotten out.
And if the community leaders and people who, you know, manage the budgets for that can understand that, that, hey, if we make this an incentive, like we have all these resources, we have all these things that we provide you to stay healthy, to stay well, and so that you can win, then it's going to be an attractive position. You know, an athlete doesn't want to join the, you know, the team, you know, but they know they're going to get paid well. They're going to have all the stuff. They're going to have all the resources, and they're going to be able to win. Well, if we can provide that to our first responders and say, hey, we have everything we need to help you to win, to be successful, not only at your career as a firefighter, as a police officer, as a dispatcher, but also in your life. You know, we're going to have, you know, financial management for you. We're going to help you manage your finances. We're going to help you, you know how to invest that the money that you make and how to not get into debt and all these things. You know, if we can provide those kind of resources to help first responders, I think maybe perhaps we'll see more people lining up to take these jobs. That, and then to cast that vision of this is what you're doing for your community. I think vision is a huge thing. And as a leader, what needs to happen to cast that kind of vision?
I think we need to start literally everything we've been talking about. I think we need to embrace that vulnerability when it comes to this. And I think that, you know, the biggest trait when it comes to a leader is someone who doesn't, lean on ego, right? You know, you think of the other members of the team and you want to build them up. When you come in as a leader, you're already starting to train the next leader. That should be the mindset. When you come in, you're already starting to train the next leader. If you're a probationary firefighter, EMT, cop, whatever it is, you come in that door, you're already training the next leader. And I think a lot of times what has happened is because of mental health, a lot of us have sort of become hinged on our ego. And when you get hinged on your ego and you're not willing to face and approach your own flaws, air quotes, weaknesses and whatnot, others won't if they look at you as a leader, even if you're not a good leader. You know, we've all had it. We've all had that captain, you know, that is, you know, gruff and tough and the guy you want to be behind when you go into that blaze, but not the guy you want to invite to your barbecue. You know what I mean? And why can't it be both? Why can't you look up to someone not only for what they're willing to do on the job, but for the way they run their life? And I think that's the true spirit of leadership, is that you always want to be able to build someone up. And in order to, with mental health, in order to embrace that and to, you know, cast that onto the other members and even next generations and the public, you have to show that vulnerability. It's not saying that every single leader in the first responder world has to be completely open with their mental health, but to shoot it down and to deny it, cast that image out upon everyone that you have contact with. And I think that's what we need to stop doing. I think we just need to stop casting out the denial of it.
Well, you know, when a leader shows a little bit of vulnerability, it gives permission to everyone else to go into that space.
It does.
Because if I'm a leader and I'm just the tough, gruff guy and I'm not, you know, suck it up type of a thing, I'm not giving permission to those around me to share.
You know, and I always tell people, I go, what does it do to you? What actually happens when you admit that things bother you? What is it? What happens? And no one can actually ever answer it short of, well, people will laugh at me or whatever. It's like, well, what does that mean though? And I get it. I mean, I spent a lot of my life not admitting to this because of that fear, but I had to look at it and be like, what does it actually matter what other people in a negative sense think when you admit to certain things or you're vulnerable? Most of the time, there is going to be a majority of people who are looking for that person to be vulnerable than there are people looking for a reason to make fun of someone or to bring that person down.
And even if they don't say it out loud, they're probably thinking, me too.
Yes. I think there's more people that do that. And when you go out and you talk about this stuff, a lot of times in my experience, you'd be surprised who pulls you aside. It's not, you know, and this is no anything on anyone who's, you know, not my height at 6'5", but oftentimes it's not the short little person in the room who comes up to you. No. It's normally the other 6'5" guy who's, you know, got a 60-inch chest and, you know, 72-inch arms who comes up. It's like, man, thank you for sharing that. There are people, every time I present, I know other people, Chris Moore being one of them, Mike Segru, Kyle Overmeyer, who have gone out and presented and had other very quote unquote tough looking men and women approach them and be like, thank you for sharing that. You literally just told a portion of my life story. There are people who want to hear it. There are a lot of people who want to hear it. And I think there's even more people who act like they don't want to hear it, who really need to hear it.
Sure.
So I my hope is that more people will start to talk about it.
So tell me a little bit about what you've been up to and what you're doing. You're speaking. I think you have a book coming out. Can I talk about that?
Yeah. So I got a lot of irons in the fire, so to speak, and I honestly wouldn't have it any other way. So I do a lot of public speaking, both in like department classroom level presentations and conferences. I actually started, one of the things that I've never really thought of doing was writing. I had been writing my own book for a while, a number of years now. And while doing so, I actually got an opportunity to write a chapter for a book that got released back in September called Scars of Stars. And it's volume 3 of it. And it was able to sort of redirect me on how I wanted to write my book, because my book is sort of in the final editing. And right before all this, I was given a few other opportunities to start writing for magazines. And, you know, some of these magazines, Fire Engineering and, you know, Firefighter Nation, I had been reading since I was a kid, you know, and I never thought of writing as something that I would do in a way of either telling my story or helping others to educate on especially mental health. And now I write for different platforms, and it has sort of become what I do between, you know, writing articles, writing my own book, writing chapters in other books, writing poetry. I write poetry, which is not something you hear a lot of men admit to, but it's cathartic because it gets out a lot of stuff. And even if you're not writing, and because, you know, a lot of my articles aren't like my story, it's a perspective on part of mental health. It's cathartic. It gets words out in front of you. When you see things you have been through in word form, it's out of you. And so that journey has been really pretty awesome. In the process, I've been part of 3 different documentaries now. Doug Haynes's Residual, Clint Du Bois, Beyond the Lights, Our Stories. And then the bigger feature length one was First Responders in Crisis, which was centered around my story. That came out in October 1st. But then sort of all this has been transitioning to me trying to figure out, like, what am I going to be when I grow up? Right. Like, I'm not on the job anymore. I'm doing a lot of things, but what am I going to sort of do? So I end up kind of starting my own, presenting an education sort of, business. And, I termed it traumatic strength, mainly because I have learned that there is an immense amount of strength in getting through and surviving and healing from trauma, specifically as a first responder, but even just as a human. And so now what I do is I have 2 different programs currently, a 2-hour and a 4-hour. The 2-hour is more of like an introduction to trauma and PTSD, hinged and centered around my story, but the how-to, what happened before, you know, what were some of the signs, how do we grow from it? And then the 4-hour kind of builds upon that with some, you know, how this can be utilized in leadership, specifically leadership in the first responder world. And it is sort of, you know, given me more of what my true identity is back, that the job itself was always my identity. I was always Fireman Hanks or EMT Hanks or Daddy or, you know, someone's husband. And doing all these other things have made me realize what my qualities are and what my actual identity is. And so all of this has been, you know, such an incredible journey of really discovering who I am, you know, right around, you know, just in time for my midlife crisis to start, you know? So it's, there's a lot of things kind of going on, and, you know, I still try to get, you know, involved with research. I'm working with, a doctor right now out of McLean's Harvard, kind of an interesting subject where we're trying to find the connection, what the connection is between, actual suicide attempts in the first responder world and childhood trauma. And because obviously a lot of suicides. And I know for me, none of my attempts had anything to do with anything I did on the job. And I've heard from other people who say the same thing. And so we're starting this sort of research project on what that link is, so we can maybe figure out where the emphasis needs to be on help and, you know, help and maybe even training. So maybe some of these men and women don't get to that point, that they're making an attempt.
Boy, that's some important work to do, because there's a lot of people to help out there. And I think it's even, you know, I think maybe some of that research will even help those who aren't involved in the first responder world, because that's, you know, there's so many people that have childhood trauma that are outside of the first responder world as well.
There is. And, you know, honestly, I think that's the hope. And I was telling someone the other day, I think the first responder world, we are looked at as leaders. And for the most part, there are some parts of it these days that, you know, we're not put on a pedestal as much. But if we can do something, if we can make a change with mental health, with how we handle it, with changing how it affects our families and domestic stuff, it can trickle down. And, and from there, you know, society can pick up what we're doing. And then it can start to maybe help some different parts of society, because there's a lot of pain.
I mean, look society. At what happened, you know, last week up in Maine, and the shooting, tragic shooting. And that gentleman was severely impacted by mental health issues.
Yep.
And there was a breakdown in how, you know, how he received help or didn't receive help.
And yeah, we just had another out by me, another city about a half hour away from me, where a gentleman killed his wife. And he had over the summer been inpatient for mental health and treated and released. They kind of spun dry him. They kind of brought him in and sent him right back out, and now his wife's dead. You know, and that's one of the
kind of a national crisis, you know, in mental health. And it's a challenge. I know back when I first got out of college, I have a degree in psychology, and I went to work at a psychiatric hospital, and insurance would pay for, and I worked in an adolescent program, kids would stay for 3 months, and you could really do something. In 3 years, when I left 3.5 years later, kids were staying for 5 days, which there's nothing you can, you know, get them to a safe place for a couple of days, but then you ship them right back into their environment. And so there's not much you can do. And so insurance, you know, there's a big issue with that, that, you know, mental health provisions that insurance provides isn't much these days.
It is. It's a handicap for a lot of this. And even like the employee assistance programs, EAPs, that a lot of, you know, first responders tend to use, you get typically it's like 4 visits. Four visits. Wow. What are you going to accomplish in 4 visits besides them learning who you are?
To just going to say you barely get to know the person, right?
Yeah. And then they're like, okay, well, if you want to continue seeing this person, you got to jump through all these hoops. And a lot of it is hinged on insurance and then policies with within organizations. And that's really hampering a lot of efforts.
Well, there's a lot of work to do. And there's some really good people like yourself that are helping to move the needle in the right direction. So thank you for that. So how can people get in touch with you? How can they find you? How can they see the film you were part of?
Yeah. So I'm pretty much all over most of social media. I don't do TikTok. I tried doing TikTok for a while. I'm not a TikTok guy.
Do the dancing.
I don't twerk. There's no twerking going on with this body. thank God, right? No, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn. I have a YouTube channel. And then, like I said, the book I wrote a chapter in is Scars of Stars, Volume 3. It's out on Amazon. The film, First Responders in Crisis, is on numerous streaming apps. It's the big, probably the biggest one is Vudu and Amazon Prime. And then it's on like 25 other ones like Xfinity and different, you know, Comcast and different things like that, DirecTV, Redbox. And, you know, then I, you know, people can reach out via my email. It's just khanksmz78@gmail.com. You know, I try to help people with resources. That's my biggest thing is a lot of people don't know what's out there. And so one of the things I've been able to do is create a database that I share with people. So anyone looking for resources, and this is like a nationwide database, there's things all over the country, they can reach out and I can send them this database, which can sometimes be the first step.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Keith, thank you so much for the work you do. Thank you for taking time to talk to me today. And I appreciate you and I wish you the most success in your new ventures and all that you do.
Thanks, Conrad. It's been a pleasure being on.
So one more question real quick. What's something fun you're going to do in the next month?
We're actually, we've started a new tradition in my house, me, my wife, and my youngest daughter, where we go away for Thanksgiving. Hmm. It was something I was always raised to be at the family table at Thanksgiving, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. Me and my wife and my youngest daughter actually go to like themed hotels now.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So we go out, we have a really cool time. We end up staying like whatever it is, like a George of the Jungle theme hotel room, whatever it is. And we just get away. And so nice. We're doing that this Thanksgiving, and it's sort of become a tradition that me and my wife started. So I'm really looking forward to that. And it always ends up being a really good time.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, again, thank you so much and look forward to hearing more from you in the future.
Thanks, Conrad.
Thank you, Keith, for the important work that you're doing. I really appreciate you coming onto the show today. I wish you well, and I look forward to seeing the book when it comes out. And thanks for listening to the show today. And if you think it was worth it, give it 5 stars and leave a review. And be sure you have subscribed to the show so you don't miss an episode. And just a reminder that you can see the video of this content on our YouTube channel. I'll leave a link in the show notes where you can access that. And please remember that you are not alone. And if you need someone to talk to and don't know where you can turn, you can dial 988 for help. Until next time, be well, take care of yourself and those around you, and go out and do something great in the world.